This may sound like a movie trailer.
The Baja cartel has their sights on the Laguna Beach Hydra business. Two young marijuana kingpins won't give it up without a fight.
But it isn't. You can find out what happens in that fight, not in a movie, but in a book. It is a trailer for a book. Trailers are a regular feature of literary marketing these days, and their quality varies widely. But as Dennis Johnson will tell you, most of the trailers are not very good. Johnson is the publisher of Melville House, a small publishing company, and he's the creator of the Mobey Awards for book trailers. And tonight he'll be handing out the second annual awards for the best and the worst. Dennis Johnson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And let's be clear from the outset. This is not the awards, not a genuine effort to honor book trailers, more of a chance to poke fun at this genre. Why?
Well, it's both, actually. There are some great book trailers. You know, it's like any other art form. There's 98% dreck, but there's 2% magnificent. But the reason we want to poke fun at it is that it's kind of early days for this in the book business, and it just seemed like, you know, maybe book people should be worrying about books more than movies.
Now, you have a lot of categories, and one of those categories is most celebtastic performance, honoring, we assume, the best celebrity appearance in a book trailer. And I'd like us to take a listen to one of them. This is the comedian Dennis Leary pushing his own book, Suck On This Year. And it sounds like a real winner.
I know this is a book trailer, but I'm going to be honest with you. This isn't even really a book. You want a book? Here's a book. Freedom, Jonathan Franzen, bestseller. Let's be honest. You probably have this at your house, or you will have it at your house. You're not going to read it. It's 600 pages. You're going to pretend you read it so your friends and your relatives think you're cool and smart. War and Peace, huh?
And he goes on to list other long books that few people are going to read. He says, unlike his book, which he says will take 12 minutes to read. Is this a common theme in book trailers, the denigration of other books in favor of a writer's own book?
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? You know, in a way, the whole concept of making a movie about your book is a denigration of your book. They're apples and oranges. I mean, one thing I noticed most this year, as opposed to last year, was that there was very little variety of form. And I felt like I was really looking at people's dreams, in the most part. A lot of what we had submitted was by self-published writers, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a different thing than it used to be. And you felt that you were watching somebody conceptualize their career, that they envisioned themselves writing this amazing, sexy book that was going to be a huge hit, and it was going to lead to this amazing, sexy movie that was going to be a huge hit. And here is the movie. So what we were getting was, you know, actual condensed narratives.
Now, but at the other end of the spectrum, well, we just heard Dennis Leary mention Jonathan Franzen's novel Freedom. And Franzen also made a trailer for that book, but it's a very different style. And it is nominated for the Mobey Award this year for Worst Performance by an Author.
Well, this might be a good place for me to register my profound discomfort at having to make videos like this, since, to me, the point of a novel is to take you to a still place.
That's a tough performance to beat in that category, Dennis.
It's kind of essence de Franzen there. It's a reenactment of his Oprah discomfort. He's very uncomfortable with talking or promoting his books. But it was an amazing video where many people weren't quite sure it was for real. You know, I've had to point out to a few people that was actually made in his publisher's office and posted on their website. They knew all about it.
That satisfied the clause in his contract that he had to make a video for the book.
Exactly. Exactly.
Here's one bit of another trailer. This one is it's narrated by the kind of voice that only does coming attractions.
He was simply gone. The only light in a boy's dark life. Ruthlessly taken. Now, as a rising Russian mafioso, the violence of Stefan Korsak's life knows no weakness.
This is a trailer for a novel called Chimera by Rob Thurman. Is it common for a trailer to sound that much like a movie trailer?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's totally common. And in fact, a lot of these are being made by people who make movie mm-hmm. trailers. That's why they sound that way. That's why they look that way. You know, they also have these awful soundtracks. We have a worst or most annoying soundtrack award because that is very typical.
So are the Klieg lights and the red carpet out for tonight's Mobeys?
There is a red carpet.
Yeah.
There is a Golden Whale Award that we hand out.
As in Moby, as in Melville House in Moby fame,
Yeah, we couldn't find a sperm whale. It's a beluga whale, but it's close enough. and we spray painted it gold, and we'll be handing that out tonight. Or if you want to get your own, they're $14.95 at Toys R Us. And we're expecting quite a crowd. We had standing room only last year, and I think it'll be bigger this year.
Well, Dennis Johnson, thanks a lot for talking with us about it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Robert.
Dennis Johnson is the founder of the book blog Moby Lives and tonight's Moby Awards, which honor the best and the worst in book trailers.
Not one picture. 1,300 pages, no pictures. Obama's War, 600 pages. Earth by Jon Stewart. You know how much this book costs? $30. Let me tell you something. This baby right here, it's a comedy pamphlet. It's got pictures and tweets, which are actually little jokes that are going to make you laugh your ass off. You know how long it's going to take you to read? 12 minutes. Front to back, 12 minutes.
This book has pictures and big print.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and we begin this hour with the E. coli outbreak that has much of Europe on edge. Scientists have begun to study the bacterium behind the outbreak, and they say it's both rare and aggressive. So far, 18 people have died, almost all in Germany, and many hundreds more have been hospitalized.
In a moment, we'll hear about how this specific strain of E. coli wreaks havoc inside the body and how it's being treated. But first, NPR's Philip Reeves reports on efforts in Europe to find the source of the bacterium.
Researchers have the germ under the microscope. It's not a pretty sight. The World Health Organization said earlier today it's a new strain of the sometimes deadly bacterium E. coli. But health authorities in the US and Britain had a closer look and say they've actually seen it before, but only in isolated cases. One thing's certain, this is the first time this vicious strain of E. coli has been associated with a major outbreak. Professor Hugh Pennington's a microbiologist at Aberdeen University in Scotland.
It certainly is as nasty as any of these particular kinds of E. coli that we've seen in the past.
More than 1,600 people are infected so far. The great majority of these are in Germany, although there are cases in at least 10 European countries and 2 suspected cases in the US, spread there by recent travellers to Germany.
We're advising anyone who's been to Germany and has symptoms, and that's of bloody diarrhoea or other things which they may be concerned about, if they have been to Germany, they should seek urgent medical attention.
That's Dr. Dillis Morgan from the Health Protection Agency in Britain, which has 7 cases. Health authorities in Europe are urgently trying to track down the source of the outbreak. The Germans initially blamed cucumbers from Spain, but changed their minds. They now just say there's a strong link to salad vegetables. That's all they know. The source could be anywhere in the production chain, from the farm to the fork. Professor Pennington says finding the source is critical.
If one could pinpoint the source, one can then do something about it and be absolutely certain that that source has now been stopped. And of course that's a problem for the Germans. They haven't been able to do that.
The bug's also poisoning diplomacy. The Spanish are angry with the Germans for falsely accusing their cucumbers. They say this has cost them dearly in lost business, and they're demanding compensation. Alvaro Torres has a vegetable stall in Madrid. He says shoppers have stopped buying cucumbers. A couple of 100 miles to the east, in Valencia, farmers dumped a big pile of fruit and veg on the doorstep of the German consulate as a protest. Relations between the European Union and Russia are also taking a hit. The EU exports hundreds of millions of dollars worth of vegetables to Russia every year. The Russians are now blocking this trade until the source of the outbreak's found. Frédéric Vincent, health spokesman for the European Commission, says they're overreacting.
We don't think it's the right move. We think this is disproportionate. And we have a safety system in the EU which is working. We do have a health situation at the moment in Germany, but we're dealing with it.
The European Commission's protested to the Russians, demanding they drop the ban immediately. Philip Reeves, NPR News, London.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. No blood test or brain scan can identify a child with autism, but scientists are trying to change that using technology that can detect unusual electrical signals in the brain. The approach could help diagnose autism earlier, and as NPR's John Hamilton reports, it's also providing hints about what therapies are likely to help.
Research shows that kids with autism do better if they start getting therapy before age 2. But Charles Nelson, a professor of pediatrics at Harvard, says that rarely happens.
Right now, the earliest we can reliably identify a child is, say, 3 years of age. We've now lost 3 years of time to do an intervention. Our work is designed to see, can we do that in early infancy, long before any signs or symptoms of autism are apparent in the child's behavior?
Nelson is part of a team that's studying the brains of autistic children using electroencephalography, or EEG. The technology records the electrical signals produced by brain cells. Nelson says kids wear a sort of hairnet that holds several dozen electrodes against their scalp.
Once that's on, the child can either sit on a parent's lap or sit in a chair by themselves if they're old enough,
while a computer analyzes the signals coming from their brain. William Basel of Children's Hospital Boston says the goal has been to find some kind of pattern in those signals that indicates autism.
So what we're looking for then are markers or features in the signals that will tell us something about the brain as it develops and differences in development.
And they've found at least one promising marker. It involves very high-frequency brainwaves known as gamma oscillations. Basel and Nelson have been studying those oscillations in about 80 children from the time they were 6 months old. Nelson says some of the kids are at high risk for developing autism because they have an older sibling with the disorder. The rest have no special risk factors.
What we've observed is that starting as young as 6 months, maybe even younger, infants who have a high risk for developing autism show dramatic reductions in gamma activity. So they show less gamma activity than do children who have no risk or a very low risk for developing the disorder.
That suggests EEG could help identify very young children who will go on to develop autism. But the researchers won't know for sure until the children in their study reach the age when the disorder becomes obvious. In the meantime, other research using EEG is revealing how autism affects the brain and how intervening early might make a difference. Sophie Mulholm of Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York has been studying how autism impairs the brain's ability to integrate information from the senses. She says a typical brain does this with ease.
We walk through the world and our sensory systems are continuously presented with stimulation, visual stimulation, auditory stimulation, touch, smells, and we very automatically put this information together to make sense of the world and to navigate it.
For example, when a person is listening to someone at a noisy cocktail party, they'll focus on that person's face, and their brain will automatically combine what they see with what they hear. But Mulholm says people with autism often have trouble doing this.
So we set up a very simple version of this where we present words in noise.
Words like bear.
Bear.
Mulholm played the words for children with autism as well as typical children. At times, the audio was accompanied by a video of a person saying the word, at other times it wasn't. Mulholm wanted to know whether the brains of children with autism react differently than other kids' brains. And they do.
What we find is that children with autism don't benefit from the visual signal nearly as much as do typically developing children.
And research using EEG indicates that's because their brains are having trouble integrating what they're seeing with what they're hearing. Mulholm says the surprising thing is that the brains of kids with autism seem to get much better at this integration when they become teenagers.
The beauty of that finding is it suggests that the neural circuitry to do this is there, it's intact, but it's just not coming online during the earlier childhood years.
Mulholm says that neural circuitry might come online sooner if these children were diagnosed early and encouraged to practice watching faces while listening to words. John Hamilton, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Stock markets were jittery again today, with investors worried that the economy is losing momentum. Major foreign exchanges experienced sell-offs following the sharp decline of more than 2% in U.S. markets yesterday. As NPR's John Itzde reports, Wall Street is responding to signs that the path to recovery remains a long, hard slog.
Mark Vittner, senior economist and managing director of Wells Fargo, says the market sell-off was a response to a tide of negative news in the past few days.
There's been a lot of disappointing economic data.
Lower than expected auto sales, for instance. Fewer new jobs in the private sector than expected. A slowdown in manufacturing growth and another slump in home prices. It's a reminder that the U.S. recovery is still anemic.
People are beginning to realize that there's no quick fix.
Couple that with a minefield created by the Greek debt crisis and the U.S. debt ceiling battle, and it makes for nervous investors, says Vittner.
I think a lot of people said, wow, I'm just not feeling as comfortable with as much money invested in the stock market, and we had a big sell-off.
After the biggest sell-off in a year yesterday, U.S. stocks bounced around today, and the Dow and S&P indexes ended slightly lower. But Vittner says he doesn't think the economy is likely to slide back into recession. Diane Swonk agrees. Swonk is chief economist and senior managing director at Mesirow Financial in Chicago. She says a number of the negative reports were just temporary speed bumps, particularly in autos and manufacturing, which were caused by the Japanese earthquake and tsunami. She says their effect on the markets, though, reveals how fragile confidence is and how difficult it is to recover from a financial crisis.
The financial crisis really left the economy hobbling. We're lucky to be growing after a financial crisis. You know, oftentimes economies contract or don't grow at all. That's the good news, is that we are growing. The bad news is we're not growing enough to recoup the losses that we endured during the recession.
This financial crisis was rooted in the housing bubble, and that's a double problem, says Vittner, because a housing recovery usually leads the way out of recessions.
You don't have to talk to an economist to figure this out. This mountain of foreclosures that we're facing, they're not going to go away overnight. They're not going to go away in a year. We still haven't figured out what we're going to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We know we're going to reform them. But until we do, I don't think that housing is going to get much momentum.
And without a recovery in housing, says Vittner, it's hard to get the kind of vigorous growth necessary to rapidly bring down unemployment, especially with so many low-skilled workers in the labor force who aren't qualified for jobs in other industries. Another challenge for the economy, says Swonk, is the completion of the Federal Reserve's quantitative easing and the end of federal stimulus programs for the states, which means more pink slips for public workers. Swonk says the problems created by the financial crisis are like those faced by a person who's had a massive coronary.
We had a massive heart attack in this country. We nearly died. Fiscal and monetary stimulus, the efforts the government did, got us into intensive care. We've now moved out of intensive care, but we're still in the hospital working on rehab. And rehab takes a long time.
That means years of slower growth and higher unemployment than we'd have coming out of a normal recession. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. Education Department today cracked down on for-profit colleges. It released new regulations that will require them to make sure their students earn enough money after they graduate to pay back their loans. The rules are part of an effort to get tough on schools that rake in lots of money but leave students with crushing debt and poor job prospects. As NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, students aren't yet sure if the new rules will help.
A handful of students in dark blue medical scrubs are taking a late afternoon break from classes at Everest College in Silver Spring, Maryland. They're all in their mid to late 20s, studying to become medical assistants. The seven-month course teaches them how to draw blood, take cultures, and other tasks. The cost to students?
The whole tuition? $16,000.
Kern Sutherland, 25, is paying that $16,000 tuition with federal grants and loans, plus a private loan from Everest College, which is like a lender of last resort.
I do think I'm getting my money's worth, but at the same time, I'm worried that I'm not going to be able to get a job after everything's done.
Sutherland says a medical assistant starting salary in the Washington, D.C. area is between $29,000 to $35,000. But he says it's hard to find a job right now. 28-year-old Kim Bailey knows that all too well. She graduated from Everest College 8 months ago.
After you left here, did you get a job?
No. I didn't.
Bailey came back to Everest College for a free refresher course. She's not sure she'll ever find a job as a medical assistant, and now she wonders if picking this career was a good idea. Bailey is glad the U.S. Department of Education is scrutinizing for-profit schools like Everest.
The people in the office, to me, they're like car salesmen, because at the end of the day, they're going to get their money. So it's up to you if you're going to stay or not, or you're going to get out before you start getting billed and you start getting mail sent to you saying you got to owe this and owe that after the 6 months or whatever be the case may be.
As far as the U.S. Education Department is concerned, this is why it's tightening its regulation of for-profit colleges. Some are taking in billions of dollars through the federal student loan program and graduating students saddled with debt and degrees they cannot use. In a conference call with reporters yesterday, Education Secretary Arne Duncan called those schools bad actors that give all for-profit institutions a bad name.
This is not about gotcha. We're asking companies that get up to 90% of their profits and their revenue from taxpayer dollars to be at least 35% effective.
In other words, if by the year 2015, schools cannot show that roughly a third of the graduates are able to secure jobs that allow them to pay back their loans, they'll be banned from the federal student loan program.
There are some significant legal questions about whether the department has the authority to take this action at all.
Ken Jenkins is spokesman for Corinthian Colleges Incorporated, which owns Everest College. Corinthian is one of the nation's biggest for-profit institutions. Jenkins says the new regulations will probably end up in court, but he agrees with Secretary Duncan.
Taxpayers should get their money's worth. Absolutely, our students should get their money's worth.
Jenkins says Corinthian schools have lowered their default rate from 21 to 12%, and they're placing 70% of the graduates in jobs. Department of Education officials are betting that by the time the new regulations go into effect in July 2012, a majority of for-profit colleges will have followed Corinthian's lead. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Book critic Maureen Corrigan has been indulging her love of American history lately. She says the three books she's chosen for her summer roundup, a narrative history, an old-fashioned historical novel, and a biography about fading frontier life, would stoke any reader's curiosity about the past. Here's her review.
Summer, when I was a kid, meant weekend road trips in our family Rambler to sites of historical interest. We'd pack up deviled ham sandwiches and Cokes and make pilgrimages from our apartment in Queens to Teddy Roosevelt's house on Long Island or Washington Irving's house in Westchester. Sometimes there were longer expeditions to Valley Forge and once Williamsburg. I'm not sure how much history I absorbed. I mostly remember a lot of candle-making demonstrations. But forever after, summer to me has been the season for traveling back in time, either by hitting the road or happily hitting the books. David McCullough is about as dependable as they come if you're in the mood for a narrative history that sweeps you through luscious detail and anecdote into a bygone age. His beguiling new book is called The Greater Journey, and it departs from works like 1776 and John Adams in that it digs deep not into a historical event or personage, but rather into a cultural trend. Between 1830 and 1900, scores of young Americans with ambitions to be painters, architects, doctors, and scientists sailed to the old world to soak up the education the new world couldn't offer. Or, as McCullough puts it, not all pioneers went west. Specifically, they traveled to Paris. Some, like Mary Cassatt and Oliver Wendell Holmes, are familiar names. Others, like the educator Emma Willard and Mary Putnam, the first American woman to graduate from a French medical school, are revelations. McCullough evokes a vision of early 19th century Paris, crowded with restaurants and gambling houses. But his greatest achievement is the realization he gives readers of how new America still was back then, sans medical schools and serious art academies. He writes of American travelers in the 1830s seeing their first glimpse of the medieval cathedral at Rouen. The Americans were agog, McCullough notes, because the largest building in the United States at the time was the Capitol in Washington. Even the most venerable houses and churches at home dated back only to the mid-17th century. so historic a landmark as Philadelphia's Independence Hall was not yet 100 years old. McCullough's book is essentially about building civilization. Jeff Shara's novel, The Final Storm, is about destruction on an almost unfathomable scale. The Final Storm chronicles the Pacific Campaign during World War II. It's the fourth in Shara's series about the war and works both as a standalone novel and the conclusion to that series. There are no postmodern literary tricks here. Instead, Shara is a master in the Herman Woke, Kenneth Roberts mode of the kind of character-driven, plot-heavy page-turner that most of us think of when we think historical novel. In his introduction, Shara reminds us of some of the staggering numbers of the Pacific Campaign. The two-week assault on Saipan resulted in 14,000 American deaths, Iwo Jima, 26,000 American casualties, and only 300 Japanese prisoners taken alive out of the 20,000 defending the island. The Final Storm is a vivid literary addition to the HBO series The Pacific, as well as films like Letters from Iwo Jima and Flags of Our Fathers, all of which underscore the peculiar brutalities and sometimes under-recognized sacrifices of the war in the Pacific. My last recommendation is a potentially annoying one because readers will have to sit tight for a couple of weeks before they get their hands on Dorothy Wickenden's alternative Western called Nothing Daunted. But I promise you, it's worth the wait. Wickenden, who's the executive editor of the New Yorker magazine, has written a superb biography that charts the adventures of her grandmother and her grandmother's best friend, society girls and Smith College graduates, who in the summer of 1916 set out to become school teachers in the isolated settlement of Elkhead, Colorado. Relying on photographs and letters that the women sent back to their anxious parents in Auburn, New York, Wickenden summons up the last moments of frontier life, where books were a luxury, and when blizzards hit, homesteaders' children would ski miles to school on curved barrel staves. David McCullough may tell us that not all pioneers went west, but some unlikely ones sure did. And Nothing Daunted also reminds us that different strains of courage can be found not just on the battlefield, but on the home front, too.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris by David McCullough, The Final Story by Jeff Shara, and Nothing Daunted by Dorothy Wickenden. You'll find details of Maureen's historical book recommendations at freshair.npr.org. And look on the NPR Books page for Maureen's summer crime and mystery picks as well. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.